Took a tree kick down the canyon on the tee shot of hole 9. No one finer as a whiner than this grumbling guest of mine on the Fish Golf Broadcast.
On this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast, I'm welcoming Cole Radalin. Cole, what you thinking about?
Oh man, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'm excited to be here in Illinois and on the tour for my fourth year already, which cannot seem real for only being 19. Unbelievable.
So for context, this is going to come out several weeks after we are recording. So we're just before the Champions Cup near Peoria, Illinois. And if I recall correctly, you had a pretty good performance at the Ledgestone tournament here last year.
Yeah, for sure. I'm definitely sad that the Ledgestone got split up into two different courses, or to one course this year in the Champions Cup overtaking Northwoods for this year. But yeah, I had a pretty good showing last year and feeling very comfortable back in the woods. It's nice to be on a disc golf course this week in the woods.
You're kind of underselling your performance. You won, right?
That's true. Yeah, I did win. I did play Northwoods pretty well. I credit a lot of that win to what I did on the final day at Eureka. However, a lot of that started here at Northwoods. So, Yeah.
What is it about this course that sets up well for you or enabled you to play well?
Yeah, I think a lot of understable or straight fairway drivers, I feel like I really thrive on the hyzer flip game, and a lot of the wind that we deal with in other parts of the year on golf courses or more open courses just doesn't really suit my game. I don't throw a lot of flex shots with overstable stuff. I certainly can, but it's not a strength of mine. So being able to come in the woods and commit to my lines with hyzer flips and fairways, playing the more understable and touch game, I think that definitely suits my game a lot better.
I'm very interested in how you evolved to that or develop your game to match that style, because for a lot of the younger players in your generation who have come up, they are very reliant on overstable, and if it goes right, they throw a forehand, if it goes left, they throw a backhand. What about the courses you played growing up or your thinking led you to understable hyzer flips?
Well, growing up in the Northwest, we're kind of in the valley where Portland is, between the Cascade Mountain Range and the coast. So I feel like we don't get a ton of wind out there. And so I started out throwing understable because that's all I could get to go far when I was younger.
Oh, because you were tiny at that point?
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, and we play a lot of wooded courses out in Oregon. I mean, Milo is one of my home courses, and sure, we have Blue Lake, but I played a lot at Horning's Hideout, if you ever played there, and that is, they got three courses out there. They're three both heavily wooded, and there's a lot of elevation, so you're having to throw understable or hyzer flips to really push up those fairways, and I just really feel like playing those, a lot of those courses is just a testament to my game, and around the 300 to 350 foot range, just pulling out a dead straight mid-range is where my comfort level is. So there's a lot of playing in the woods up in the Northwest, whereas I think, you know, some players and more of the Midwest have a lot more open style tracks.
When we played together at the first round of Waco this year, you talked about how you were kind of undergoing a mechanical journey and trying to like fix and optimize what you were doing and how you were throwing. Can you describe what that looks like for you?
Yeah, totally. It's been a wild ride the last couple of years. I went from copying Paul McBeth for a while and my form
The first time I saw you, your putt had the toe waggle and everything.
Yeah. My putt and throw looked nothing like Paul, even though it felt like it in my mind. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was just a lot of unnecessary motion that I was using, especially for my body type, just being a little taller and lankier. And I really had to develop something that was my own. And so from there, hilariously, I started kind of copying after Drew Gibson and the snap that he got off of his throw. Now, the funniest part about that is him and Paul have a similar build and one completely different to mine. So it might be strange, like, why would you copy them if their build isn't the same as yours? But I just really admired the way that they spun the disc, so straight and so smooth. And so at the end of 2021, I started copying after Jute, completely changed my form. The spin of my disc completely changed. And going from there, it slowly developed into my own thing, which I'm very happy about, because I think in order to unlock your full potential, you got to kind of find what works for you. And so it's been really nice being in that zone and fine tuning those things. Now, last year, I was kind of trying to straighten out my arm a little bit more, I think, throughout the year.
At what point of the throw?
Kind of in the reach back. So I would get through my X step and everything. As soon as I reach back, I'd be reaching kind of up and behind myself a little bit.
Okay.
And letting my arm kind of fall behind me, but like almost behind me too much. And so I've just been working really hard this last off season to get my arm down and out so I can really maximize the amount of snap and throughout the power pocket, and just drawing my arm straight into my body instead of trying to round my arm through my body. Because I think pulling your arm straight into your body gives you a lot more accuracy and consistency in what you're doing as far as rounding it around your body.
Definitely. And I think this is something that I too have experienced. So when you are a hyzer player, you can kind of get away with rounding a little bit.
Totally.
Because that is, in a weird way, it kind of works out to a net straight pull through.
Yeah.
But anytime you have to throw flat or anhyzer, you clearly are rounding. And if you don't hit your timing absolutely perfectly, it all goes to shit.
Like, yeah.
You stall the disc out to the left every time.
Absolutely.
What technology or drills or feedback have you been using to relearn how to throw?
Really nothing. Just a ton of time in front of the camera and the net. Just filming myself constantly about where my arm is, where my plant foot is, where my back foot is, just all of those things, trying to get them to look the way I want them to and also feel the way I want them to. I feel like there's a local player, Scott Withers, in our area, does a really good job at reaching low and out. I know Gannon does a good job at reaching low and out. And so there's just some players that I've seen. Paul reaches out, but he's a little higher in his backswing. Simon reaches out really well. So there's like all of those guys kind of towards the top of the game, just admiring what they're doing with their arm, how they're getting the maximum amount of consistency in their throw. So really just seeing how they're incorporating their arm with their body, I think was the biggest help for me going through this process and trying to achieve that myself.
This is all very interesting. And I think I resisted trying to change stuff because it worked. I was getting results even if it didn't really look like anybody else. And I have tried to converge to some extent. Like, I've raised my arm slot by probably 3 or 4 inches over the last year on purpose. You were getting results. Why did you decide to change?
I felt like I was getting results without like feeling totally in control, maybe. I felt like walking up to every shot, there always felt like this chance that it wasn't going to execute the way I wanted. And it felt like my form was the reason behind that. And I think maybe it's more of a mental drive for me. Just having that mental comfort in my head that's being like, what you're doing is correct, so just get out there and execute. If I don't believe what I'm doing is correct, then I think it's harder for me to really settle into belonging there. You know, I've talked to a lot of players and how they're like, well, don't change because this is what works for you. So just keep doing what you're doing and let that evolve, which I agree to an extent. But if the basics aren't found in that, I think it can develop worse habits over time. And so I want to prevent the habits from building on top of each other and iron those kinks out pretty early in my career, so that now the way my form is right now, that can evolve over the years rather than, you know, something that wasn't quite as working well. I've always said, like, if you're going to change something, as long as it doesn't make you worse, it's not a bad change. And so I don't feel like a change that I've ever made has made me a worse player.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of the day, if I'm changing things to try to improve my game, but at the end of the day, it's not making me a worse disc golfer, then I don't see anything wrong with changing at all.
Sure. Have you experienced that making mechanical tweaks makes you worse in the short term while you'd like try to regain the feel?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like taking a step back to take 2 steps forward, I think. It might not make your performance on the course worse, but you might take a little longer to get fully comfortable with what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Again, So I feel like when I really changed my form, I was constantly in like, you know, 30 to 40th place kind of, and I just couldn't really get out of that zone. But once I started feeling much more comfortable in it and coming out of that shell, I was able to gather some more top finishes towards the middle of the year to the end of the year in 2022. And then last year with my Foley breakout year, having another off season throughout the form change, just really gave me a lot of confidence for last year. And then towards the end of last year, I felt myself kind of slipping out of paying attention to where my throw was. And this off season's where I really just kind of nailed it, and doing so much work in the net, trying to just get it down, and starting to feel so comfortable about where the disc is coming out of my hand and what angles I'm using. Yeah, I think over time it'll take a step back to take a step forward, but it's definitely going to be worth it.
That's all really cool. Can we talk about feel as a concept? This is one of the hardest things to master and retain, like throughout an entire event or throughout an entire month or season. What is feel?
Yeah, that's a tough question.
It's just a big ass abstraction.
Yeah,
right?
Sure. Yeah, it's I think it's something that can give you so much confidence, but something that can also just tear your game apart. It's a total, I feel like feel is such a mental thing, because you can walk up to any shot and just like have this feeling that it's going to be awesome, or just like with the way your game is, and you're just going to execute it every single time. But if you've mis-executed a few shots and you walk up to the shot and you're not feeling good about it, well, then it's not going to be good at all. So I feel like feel comes out to more of something like a mental preparation than a physical feeling about what you're doing.
I've kind of asked a question similar to this to players who come from a region with a really high density of good players. So you're 19, and that means that growing up in Oregon, you probably spent years getting stomped by Scott Withers.
Yeah.
Oregon has historically had a bunch of other really, really good players come out of there. Like Nate Doss lived there. Dave Feldberg was there for a little bit. Avery Jenkins was there for a little bit. And now there's kind of a younger generation where, you know, yourself and Dallas Garber and, geez, there's probably guys that I don't even know. What is it about...
The Nava brothers.
Yeah. What is it about Oregon disc golf that lends itself to having such a high density of quality players?
I'm super thankful for it, because it's definitely pushed me to levels that I didn't think I could achieve. I won my last amateur event averaging 10-30, winning by like 18 strokes, and then they're like, okay, get out of our field.
Very much, yes.
Yeah. But it was crazy, because as soon as I turned pro, you had to average 1040 or 1050 to win a B tier. And, you know, I see in other states how they're like, oh, I won my first B tier. And I look at the rating average and they're like, you know, 1,010 or whatever. I'm like, what in the world? that did not happen in Oregon. If you wanted to win any sort of event in Oregon, you had to shoot double digits around, and you had to be averaging at least above the 1040 mark to have a chance, which I think is so cool. And just the way our courses are designed up in the Northwest, we're just very blessed and thankful to have such beautiful properties that we get to play on. And I think it's a lot more motivating for people to get out and play when there's so many awesome, beautiful courses around you. So that honestly just spikes the level of play so much, because people are so much more motivated to get out there. But yeah, I mean, Nate Sexton just recently moved back to Salem, Oregon, which is about an hour south of where I live. So that's cool to have him kind of still there. And then Scott obviously has been there for as long as I can remember. But yeah, he was definitely like the mark. Like if you wanted to be winning an Oregon tournament, you had to go through Scott. Like he was the final boss. and I remember my first B tier win, I played two tournaments on the same course back to back, both one weekend apart. So I played one tournament at this course, and then we had a week off, and then another at that same course, another tournament. And that first tournament, this was the year of 2021. I was newly sponsored by Discraft, and I had just gotten on their core team, and it was like my second or third event of the year. And I shot like a two over the first round. This is relatively the hardest course in Oregon. Shot a two over the first round. The second round I shot seven over. I was nine over for the tournament, and I took like 21st or something like that. Every single day for the next 2 weeks, I went and practice that course. I'm homeschooled, so I was homeschooled at this time, so I just do my schoolwork, I drive out to the course, and I just play it. It was pretty much every single day. I want to say probably at least 10 to 12 days out of the next 14 days, I was at that course just grinding. I come back to that course 2 weeks later, and round one, I shoot the course record of 9 under par. 11 strokes better than my first round of the same course 2 weeks before. I shoot the course record 9 under. I go on to shoot 4 under the next round and win the tournament by 4 or 5 strokes for my first pro win. And that right there is just like a testament to the field, but also like my growth in that area. It was such a cool defining moment. But Scott was in that field, and he had shot like a 5 under the first round or something, and then like a 4 under the second round or whatever. And it was just like, whoa, like holy cow, like I just blew out the field on one of the hardest courses in Oregon. Like that, if there's anything that'll boost your confidence going into your first season on the pro tour, that's something that will do it. So yeah, growing up in there just pushed me so much. It made me work harder than I thought I was able to work.
I think around that time I was texting with Dion Arlen, and he said, watch out for this kid, 1040 this time next year, book it now. And you didn't quite do it, but it was like you jumped from, I don't know, 1010 to 1029 or something. And right. I was like, okay, like Dion, you weren't technically right, but like vibes based, you were. Sure.
I'm Ella Hansen, and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I visit baseball players' graves.
I'm Felix with Ace Run Productions, and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I'm traveling to yet another town that you've never heard of.
You know, I spent all of season one in this very ad break saying that we would never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads. But lately, I've had a change of heart. The integrity of this show absolutely has a price. We're talking lake house money. Private island money. Lake house on a private island money. But until that hypothetical benevolent corporate overlord speaks up, though, this show is entirely supported by your support of me and my sponsors. Fish Stamp Discraft discs are available in-store and online at daddydiscgolf.com, dischub.com, and treemagnets.com, and fishdiscgolf.com when I'm not traveling. You can save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10 at checkout, unless you're a fool who likes spending full price on disc golf bags. And of course, our name is derived from Disc Golf Bra, whose media channels and website you should visit for outstanding New England content. And now, more mutual hostility between Fish and the guest. Let's talk about that practice regimen. You kind of got beat up by the course, and then you went back every day and you figured it out. In some ways, that's not that different than going to a pro tour stop now. You don't have to go play 12 out of 14 days on the same course to figure it out. Now you've got 2 or 3 usually.
Right.
Can you talk about how that experience is similar to what it's like during a pro tour tournament week, where you've got to figure out of bounds and distances and wind and just like developing a game plan that suits you, even if the guys that you're playing with are doing something entirely different?
Yeah, I think that's still some growth that I need to do, and something I need to figure out. You know, what is that? How do I analyze the hole? I feel like I'm too easily influenced about what other guys are doing. Like, ooh, they're throwing the flex shot. Like, oh, that makes so much sense. But
I'm gonna manipulate you so hard.
but I need to, like, even if it's not the greatest shot for the hole, you got to stick to what you're most comfortable with as well. But there's also a good mix. You know, sometimes you just have to throw the forehand, and it's like, well, that is the most predictable shot, and it's what's going to put me in bounds every time, so I'm just going to throw the forehand. Yeah, I definitely think that's a part of my growing that can still happen, is analyzing the course a little bit deeper during practice, taking practice a little more seriously. I think a lot of pros just kind of walk through the course and pick a disc for the hole, and that's all that they do. And so if there's anything that I want to, you know, put my mind to a little bit more, it's taking a look backwards. You know, when you get to the basket, look backwards and see where all the trees are from that vantage point. Or you know, analyze the OB line in the woods to the left or in the open on the right. Like, how much space do you have?
Do you think that a course like Northwood, where we are right now, where there are lots of different shots, do you think that that is what we should be seeking? Or are you fine with places where, you know, it's wide open and everybody just kind of throws a hyzer?
I mean, I said at the beginning of this interview, it feels really good to be on a disc golf course this week, because I just think this is what disc golf should be, playing in courses like this. Northwoods, if you're hitting your lines, you're in the fairway and you're scoring. Whereas there's some other wooded courses where if you hit your line, you hit the middle tree, you either kick out of bounds, you kick in the water, or you kick elsewhere. I could mention a course, but I'm not going to.
You should. No, seriously. Like,
yeah.
I think it's really important that we have feedback out there in like a thought out way, not just being critical and ending our discussion there.
Sure.
Like, what do you like and what do you dislike? Where should we go from here?
Yeah, I think trees in the fairway just need to go. I don't really care how wide or how skinny that tree is. Like, sure, some make the hole, so where you're splitting up the fairway into two, but the fairway better be wide enough on both sides. Because if you got a, you know, 15 to 20 foot wide fairway and then you stick a foot and a half wide tree in the middle of it, you know, they're like, oh, well, you could take the right side or the left side. And I'm like, well, what if I just want to lace a shot down the middle and feel deserved about throwing a really good tee shot? And so that's something I just so much love and appreciate about Northwoods, is if you throw it in the right landing zones, you're going to have a pretty doable next shot. Mm-hmm. I know you said that you think there's a lot of versatility or a lot of different shots on this course. I only throw four or five discs off the tee out here. I mean, I throw the same disc on different angles or hyzer flips or just slow it down my form a little bit. Through the entire back nine, I throw a tsunami, aftershock, and pipeline on like every single tee shot. It's because I can just manipulate those discs into shaping lines in the trees. And I honestly think that's a greater skill than throwing a hyzer distance driver at Jonesboro or a hyzer distance driver at Music City Open. So I'm just super thrilled to be in here. I also think that the weather has been really naughty this year with all of the wind that we've had. And I just don't want to get going about the wind, because that's totally out of our control. But at the end of the day, like, playing on courses like this just makes our game so much more fair and skillful, because the wind isn't as big of a factor as it is on those open courses, where I think there's just too many uncontrollable variables that I don't think belong in our game, and it makes players look worse than they are. And I don't think that's a good view.
I kind of like it when it's windy. It has been very stressful basically playing wind golf for the last month or so.
Yeah.
Because, like, here's something that I've been dealing with. Throughout a tournament, I'll have great practice rounds. And then I'll throw the disc really well throughout the whole tournament. But my putting confidence will just decrease. And I think that's very wind-based.
Totally.
Because, like, I'm not getting the feedback of, I made a good run from 40 feet and I hit an inch low. It's like, no, the wind dropped that and I barely hit the pole in the air.
Yeah.
And by the fourth round of a tournament, it's like, man, like, all I want to do is get it to the basket. That's like, that would be a victory. I think it's important that we have diversity in player skills. Like, throwing far is a skill.
Of course.
You throw further than me. If we play a 550 hole, like, you should have a better opportunity to score on it than I do.
Yeah.
But the Pro Tour has kind of made choices for spectators and whatever other logistical considerations that it kind of feels like we just do that over and over and over again every week. And we lose the diversity of shot shaping and playing landing zone golf and par being a really good score instead of birdie or you're out of the tournament.
Mm-hmm. I think probably that is my biggest frustration, is, you know, how many back-to-back-to-back-to-back weeks we've played on very similar tracks. You know, one thing I love about Northwoods Black is if you throw a bad shot, you know you threw a bad shot. Whereas some of these more open courses, playing a little bit of the breeze, you could be out by an inch when you threw a great hyzer and got this lift, or you got this drop, or like you're saying with the putt, it's just like, I don't know what release I have because the wind is just going to do whatever it wants with it. And so I don't absolutely despise the wind completely, because I think it brings a really interesting factor in the risk reward with throwing the disc further up in the air on these big courses. You know, some players who try to go over the top in the wind, it's just going to stall right back to you. Whereas if there's no wind, well, then you might actually throw a good shot. I think it makes it very interesting, but I don't think it's where the sport needs to be every single week. And I understand the spectators in the game and getting them out there and prioritizing that. But yeah, I think that's just a kind of a growing pain that we're going to have to go through and figure out. But something I really like about Northwoods is, like, you can take a par and be like, all right, sweet, you know, on to the next one.
Yeah, you know.
And that's, we don't get to feel that often. If you miss a birdie on the pro tour right now, you're kicking yourself. I don't think that's the way golf should be. And I'm actually really proud and happy that my first pro tour victory was on this track, because I think mentally it helps me stay within myself if I know I'm fully in control of every shot that's in front of me playing through the woods, because you see the line and you know the shot you have to throw. So when you don't execute, you're like, oh, well, here's how I'm going to analyze this shot. It's, what the heck is the wind doing? Every single player in every tournament for the last 3 weeks has been like, what is that drop? What is that lift? You know, like, I'm just sick and tired of hearing that.
And here, if you and another player are 100 feet apart, like left, right, after a tee shot, at least one of you threw a terrible shot.
Absolutely.
And yeah, in open golf, that's totally normal to play 100 feet apart.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about geography and how the Northwest is just kind of isolated right now. You've been driving for all of your tournaments, and now you've got a camper as well as like a little roller skate that you can tool around in. Do you feel like there's an advantage, a disadvantage, or if it's neutral, that there are two Pro Tour tournaments in Portland, but the next closest Pro Tour stop is like 15 hours away?
Yeah, I think it's pretty messed up. I think I love that there's two events in Oregon. I think Glendevere is such an entertaining track for people to watch, and it's pretty awesome. With all the big trees lining the fairways, it's cool to actually play around trees and not branches. We don't get to do that often in the beautiful Doug Furs and the golf course. That's definitely a course that I love to play, but also the beauty of Milo as well. I know a lot of pros like continuing going back there, and some of the changes they've made to the course have been pretty good. I kind of miss the old East and West, but I think that's where the course is trying to evolve.
It kind of removes the dud holes, even yes, if it did remove a couple really special ones too.
Absolutely, yeah. So yeah, I honestly, you know, there's some bias in me because that's where I grew up, so I'm pretty happy that there's two pro tours 30 minutes away from each other. But at the end of the day, the crowds are showing up for it, and I think the pros love being able to stay at the same place for 2 weeks and play two pro tours, and it's a beautiful place to be. It's a little different than going to Texas, and then you're stuck in Texas for like 3 weeks and you're like, why are we still in Texas? But if you're in the Northwest, I don't really feel like you're complaining. I really don't think it's wise to take Las Vegas off the pro tour when you could just, after DDO, you just shoot down to Vegas and then even go to Masters Cup still, and then go up to OTB, and then like you just kind of make it a perfect oval. And I think there's some really cool courses in Montana that I've heard, or Idaho, or, you know, up in the Rocky Mountain Range area, where if you try to get it close to a city like Boise, or, you know, any other place, like on the way out from Oregon towards the preserve, it could make a full loop and make it a little more enticing for people to go. Sure, you might add a few hours to each trek that you go out there.
We can't say, oh, that's 2 hours out of the way, that's not worth it, when Portland to Minnesota is like 26 hours driving already.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Very small potatoes, especially if there's like, if you're allowing a week in between the pro tour stops.
Of course.
So it sounds like you've thrown out a couple options that in a dream world might make sense for sequencing the pro tour. If you did that, then there would kind of be the obligation to do it elsewhere, near other population centers in the U.S., and that would balloon us up to 30 or 35 events a year. Now, for the operations staff, that's clearly not
course,
logistically possible.
Yeah.
But for players, whiny players who are saying there's too many events and the courses are too long and we can't play every week, you know, where's the push and pull on that?
It's kind of ridiculous. I'm okay with playing four or five events in a row. I think it's I honestly think that as professional athletes and we should be training or competing as such. I think travel is stressful and it puts a strain on us, but if the tour makes sense, then I think so. I don't think we should have more than like 20 or a little more than that events in a season.
Yeah, we're at like 16 to 18 plus four majors right now.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty solid balance. But I mean, like I was saying, if you add some extra events that make sense, like keeping Vegas or whatever, then why are we going to? I mean, why are we going to Jonesboro, Arkansas? I just think there's like bigger. There's bigger cities and bigger places that we can go. And honestly, I don't really care too much about how many events that we play as much as it is how much does this event make sense for the Pro Tour and the flow, and how many people are we getting out there to spectate the course?
Yeah. And this is a conversation that you and I don't have a whole lot of say in. I don't have access to the financials or spectator numbers,
right?
And like, I really like Disc Side of Heaven as a course,
yeah,
but Jonesboro is almost too small to support that. Like, there's 170,000 people there, you're an hour and a half from Memphis, mm-hmm. So like the spectators didn't really show up this year. Mm-hmm. And did you play DDO last year?
I did, yeah.
How many people were there?
I don't know. I could probably count on two hands.
That's rough. Like, I'm not trying to make a value judgment on whether Jonesboro or Emporia should be on the tour. At some point, simply having been on the tour previously, that isn't necessarily qualification for being on it in future.
Yeah. And also weigh the courses, you know, in, like the Country Club or the Disc Side of Heaven. Sure, they're fun tracks, but... Like you're saying.
I agree with half of your statement. It's not just the Pro Tour that has difficulty locating event venues in the Northwest and then having reasonable ways to get to and from there. What's the closest professional baseball team to the Seattle Mariners?
probably the Giants.
It'll be the A's once they move to Sacramento.
Okay.
but like, how far is that drive? That's really far.
Yeah, totally.
And then like the Colorado Rockies are a 16-hour drive from any other team.
True.
You know, if we host a Pro Tour event in Denver or Salt Lake City or, like you're saying, Boise, Idaho, it doesn't matter where we go from there. It's far.
Yeah.
We kind of just have to embrace that as geography and know that you can't just go from Peoria to Cincinnati.
Right.
And it's half a day's drive because that's not the way the population centers are built in the West.
Right.
This is a little riff that doesn't quite make sense for us to try to parse out, but you know, in a dream world, it would be really cool if, you know, you could go back and forth from your home base to a couple more pro events.
Yeah.
Let's talk about when you are home though, and your family hosts how many friggin' professional disc golfers for 2 weeks?
Yeah. I mean, well, we've kept it pretty small over the last couple of years, just some close friends. This year we're definitely downsizing. I don't think we're really doing anybody this year.
Who ruined it for everybody?
Nobody ruined it. I think it's, you know, I'm growing up now, so I'm not home as much anymore. And I think we just want to really soak up family time as much as we can while I'm there. And it's nice to have a quiet house just with family. And I think that's something that, you know, we're going to try this year and I think is going to be pretty nice. Not that we don't love having company or, you know, hosting other people, but I do believe that there's a cool element for me, at least in the inability for me to just go home and hop back on the tour because we're so far out of the way, to just kind of go home and relax in my space and, you know, not have too many people around. It is hard because you want people to stay with you, because I'm staying alone in my RV every single week. I travel by myself. But then again, when you have family around, it's like, well, now I just want to soak up family time. So yeah, we hosted like 5 or 6 people last year. And then the year before that, it was just 2. And then this year, I think it's just 1. So yeah.
Okay. Well, the Radalin family getting steadily less generous on the Portland swing. We'll keep an eye on that in future years.
We're sticklers.
All right. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to lavish praise on me, you can find me on Instagram and whatever the fuck Twitter is at fish58320. And if you hated the podcast, you found the guest dull, and you want to yell at him about how junky his mechanics are, where can folks find you, Cole?
Yeah, I'd really appreciate your guys' negative feedback on my social media, Cole Radalin on Instagram and Cole Radalin on Facebook.
And do you have any discs or other merch that folks can get to support your tour?
Yeah, absolutely, guys. Go to otbdiscs.com/Cole, and I got some discs on sale right now for 15% off, some Tsunamis and Pipelines, and we just had the tour series released for this year, so I got some more Pipelines going there, and some really cool apparel coming soon for my first ever apparel drop, so excited for that.
There you go. Hope it fits. Thanks, Cole. That's a wrap on this week's Fish Golf Broadcast. Join us next week to fritter away more of your ever-waning life force on two jabronis talking about Frisbee. Please support the show, if you're able, by shopping for fish stuff at fishdiscgolf.com, Daddy Disc Golf, Disc Hub, Tree Magnets, and Disc Golf Bras websites. You can still save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10, and please tell a friend about this show. Unless you don't have any friends, but that's your problem, not mine.